So where exactly does Ronald McDonald stand on net neutrality? We're not going to answer that question, but we're going to talk a lot about net neutrality, open competition, what the EU thinks about it. And we're going to talk about trademark parody, satire, and whether Evan and or Stephen Colbert should be canceled. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 253, recorded April 4th, 2014. Chewy Vuitton, sit. Hi, folks. You're joining us for This Week in Law, where we bring you some of the most brilliant people I've ever had the chance to come into contact with. We're so lucky to do this show. You're lucky to be listening, because what we do is we help you understand all those difficult issues at the juncture of technology and law, net neutrality being one of the rockiest these days. And to help us out today, we've got Professor Daniel Lyons from Boston College Law School, who is a scholar in that area, telecommunications law, internet regulation in general. We're so thrilled to have you, Daniel.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also joining us, it's been too long, Marty Schwimmer, our resident trademark specialist. There have been a lot of good, exciting, interesting things going on in the trademark arena since last we had Marty on the show. So we're so thrilled you could come back.
Denise, it is good to be back.
And joining us from Chicago, Illinois, and the law firm of the Info Law Group is Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Great to see you as always. Should be a really fun conversation. Looking forward to it.
Great to see you too. I think we'll start with the meaty stuff since, you know, we've had lots of people on trying to help us get our heads around what's going on in the wild and woolly world of net neutrality since the Verizon decision. So I think we'll start there and we'll get Daniel's take and try and get through some of the thornier issues. Why don't we start with something, with a couple of things much in the news this week. First of all, is Reed Hastings coming out and saying, gee, you know, we did this deal with Comcast, but our feet were really held to the fire to make that happen. The FCC this week has sort of responded to that and said, look, you know, we're not really going to expand net neutrality based on what happened to you there, Netflix. Thanks for letting us know, Reed Hastings. Can you give us your take on these developments, Daniel?
Sure. So it's a good example of the fact that net neutrality is a somewhat elastic term, right, that means different things to different people. Traditionally, what most people have thought of as net neutrality has been about discrimination in the last mile, right? The wires that go into your home that Comcast or Verizon or whichever providers are providing to connect your house to the internet. One thing that comes out of the Comcast-Netflix debate is that it allows us to correct a little bit of a misnomer, which is that a lot of people sort of assume without much analysis that Netflix actually pays very little or nothing to get its content up to the internet. And it turns out not to be true, right? So Netflix traditionally has partnered with a number of intermediary companies, right? Cogent Communications and Level 3, companies that are responsible for interconnecting Netflix's servers with the Comcast and the broadbands of the world. Comcast and Verizon's of the world. And these are transit providers, interconnection providers. They are operate deep in the bowels of the internet. We don't really know much about them. And so the recent dispute between Netflix and Comcast or Netflix and Verizon has really brought them more into the spotlight. So traditionally, Netflix pays companies like Cogent to carry their traffic to the internet. And then it's Cogent is contractually obligated to make sure the information gets from their network to Comcast or Verizon or the other broadband networks that carry it the traffic through to the end user consumer. The problem recently has been that Netflix has grown so much. They're now, I think, somewhere like one-third of all internet traffic during peak times, that the amount of traffic that they're pushing through is overloading the connections between Cogent's network and the networks of broadband providers like Comcast and Verizon. And so Cogent, in order to make sure that Netflix traffic moves smoothly through the network of networks that make up the internet, right, they need to upgrade the connections between Cogent's network and Comcast network. And Cogent was of the view that Comcast should pay for some of this, and Comcast was of the view that if it's Cogent's traffic that's causing the connections to be overloaded, that Cogent should be on the hook for it. So while Cogent and Comcast are fighting over who's going to pay for the upgrade, it's Netflix consumers that were suffering because it's Netflix traffic that was getting caught at the bottleneck. So my sense is that Netflix got tired of being stuck in the middle of this dispute and cut a deal that essentially eliminated the middleman, right? Rather than going to carrying their traffic from Netflix to Cogent and then from Cogent to Comcast, they cut a deal directly with Comcast so that Netflix is connected directly to Comcast in order to make sure that the traffic would carry through without interruption. From Rudy Hastings' perspective, it seems to me that it's, you know, you pay one company or you pay another, so they're shifting money from one bucket to another. But Hastings is using this as an example to show that Comcast may be increasing its footprint in the upstream in the interconnection and transit space, and is hoping that the FCC will take a closer look at those types of agreements going forward.
All right. So further on the Comcast front is this rumor that Apple is working on a deal. None of this is confirmed. You know, it's sort of sources close to the negotiations tell the Wall Street Journal kind of thing, that Comcast and Apple are working. And that, you know, similarly, Apple was working previously with Time Warner on a similar deal to do some sort of deal around Apple TV, where the cable company's subscribers would have access to Apple TV, and that, and here's where the net neutrality piece comes in, things delivered via Apple TV would get preferential treatment. This is one of those kind of free market, hey, you know, we're going to do deals that make sense. And this is how companies compete with each other, kind of arrangements. But, it's definitely, raising eyebrows and causing people to be concerned about the precedent it might set. Again, it's hard to talk about something that's not confirmed and hasn't happened yet. But Daniel, I'm curious to get your take on these kinds of arrangements.
Well, it's definitely skirting at the edge of net neutrality, right? So although the Verizon court struck down the net neutrality rules for providers generally, Comcast remains bound by the net neutrality rules by virtue of their commitments when they assumed NBC Universal, right? So one of the conditions of them being able to allow, being able to purchase the NBC Universal Empire was that they had to agree to abide by net neutrality restrictions at least until 2018. So the question here is whether the deal they're cutting with Apple is a net neutrality violation or not. Based on the limited information that's out there so far, it looks like it fits into one of the exceptions to the net neutrality rules, although it's unclear whether exactly what the FCC had in mind when they wrote the exceptions, right? So net neutrality was never meant to apply to all of the information that's coming through the Comcast wires into your house. The FCC recognized that Comcast and other broadband providers are not only your internet provider, they also do other services as well. And those services share the some space within the wire to your house. And a lot of those services won't work unless they get some sort of priority treatment. The best example of this is cable television, right? Cable television, because it's enormously data intensive, it needs a priority part of the broadband network that's coming into your home. So in the event that there's congestion, Comcast is allowed to send its cable product through first in order to make sure that its cable customers get the cable content that they purchased, even if it means the broadband side ends up getting slowed down. So this exception was an exception known as a managed services exception or a specialized services exception. And in addition to cable, it would apply to, you know, traditional telephone service or home alarm service, which is something that broadband companies are starting to dabble in. Anything that's not traditional access to the public internet. The question here is whether Comcast can take advantage of that exception for deals that they're striking with someone else. Right. So in this case, if the rumors of the Wall Street Journal are suggested are true, the idea was that data coming into your Apple TV unit, right, would not be carried over the public internet the way that a YouTube video or Skype call is, but instead would get priority treatment in another part of the broadband pipe, the same way that Comcast's own cable service is. And so that means that in the event of congestion, your Apple stream would not be interrupted. If you look closely at the details of the NBC Universal merger, it seems like the FCC thought it was okay for Comcast to strike these kinds of deals with third parties as long as they make similar terms available to any other interested party. It's sort of like the post office, right? Anybody can get regular first class mail. If you want to pay more, you can get the priority mail delivery, but the post office couldn't offer priority mail unless they made sure that everybody who walked in could get priority mail if they chose to. Generally, I think this is a good thing. I think we're in as video is increasingly dominating the internet marketplace, we're looking at new and different ways for broadband providers to price the products that they're offering to consumers. Sometimes these sorts of things can look anti-competitive on the surface, but wind up in the long run being a good thing. And one example of that would be the deal that Apple struck with AT&T, right, for the original iPhone. For the first few years of the iPhone, the only place you could get an iPhone was from AT&T. And people thought, you know, that seems like it's anti-competitive. It's hurting Verizon and T-Mobile and other smartphone companies that can't offer this thing that everybody wants. But that turned out to be a good deal in the long run, because it led to Verizon pouring some money into Android as an alternative, right? And now we have robust facilities-based competition between two different operating systems, iOS and the Android system. And I think that Verizon's actions along with Google to help wake up a sleepy smartphone market would not have happened if AT&T had not given a big bunch of money to Apple in order to be the exclusive provider of the iPhone. So I think it's important for the FCC to keep an eye on these sorts of deals, make sure that whatever agreement gets struck is one that passes traditional antitrust review. But generally, I think it makes sense to allow broadband providers to experiment in this space.
Marty, do you think this is a little bit too cute by half for them to sneak through this managed services exception and say, okay, if it's coming through on an Apple TV, that's not really the internet?
Why is it not really the internet?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I think it is. It's just, you know, deciding what they're going to classify as internet versus not internet. You know, if it's just another box hooked up to your internet connection. And because, you know, again, this hasn't happened, but if it does, the box that says Apple TV is going to have a better caliber of service than the box that says Mac Mini or some other way of bringing the internet to your television screen. Does that seem like just crawling through a loophole in the net neutrality laws?
I mean, there is a cable that comes out of your wall that's using the IP protocol. And then there's a variety of devices that connect to that. I happen to have a Google TV that connects to it in one room, and I have a Roku box in another room. I don't understand how you can say that one is internet and one isn't.
Yeah,
I just don't get the loophole.
Well, I do get what I'm trying to ask here, Daniel, is that, you know, it's all the internet, and simply by saying we're not going to treat an Apple TV as we would another internet connected device because we've done a deal, we Comcast. Doesn't that seem problematic?
It seems problematic if it does, I think, seem a little bit like an end run around the net neutrality rules, right? If the whole point of the rules was to make sure that whatever's coming from the public internet looks and walks and talks exactly like every other packet that comes from the public internet, right? Then it's not necessarily problematic. I think the difficulty lies not in whether this is or is not a legitimate exception to the net neutrality rules, but whether the net neutrality rules still make sense, right, in an increasingly diverse product market. Right, so if you end up, you have, say, four different streams that come through the internet simultaneously, right? One is an email, one is HTML web page, one is part of a streaming video conversation, and one is a telemedicine stream, right? Somebody is performing surgery in Missouri and is getting the assistance via telemedicine app of a surgeon in New York, right? And so all four of these streams hit a juncture at the same time to where we need to prioritize them. The net neutrality rules traditionally, right, would say you can't give priority to one service over another, that they all need to be treated exactly the same. And from an end-user perspective, I'm not sure that makes a lot of sense, right? So because the delay in packet delivery varies depending on the service that you're receiving. If I get a delay in the email packet, it's going to be imperceptible to me as a consumer. And similarly, a delay in getting part of a web page, maybe the web page loads a little bit more slowly, a few microseconds, whatever, right? But a delay in a streaming video stream, right, ends up with that weird skip thing, right, that you get when you have, and it degrades the quality of the connection. And then when we talk about the telemedicine app, right, it's even worse. And so the FCC has been dealing with this problem. They had what they called an exception to the net neutrality rules for reasonable network management, but they never really defined what that was, and they never really got to the point of thinking whether different uses of the IP protocol would require preferences or not. But if you accept that, you know, some services are hurt by congestion and some are not, and therefore that you might need to prioritize some over others, then the question becomes, how do you prioritize, right? You can have a Comcast guessing, looking at each packet that's coming in and guessing based on what it is, which one gets priority over others. Or you can have the price mechanism do that for them, right? To offer some sort of priority access in order to, and then allow companies that whose services need prioritization to pay for that product. And that's the way I see this sort of Apple deal. Apple's recognizing that streaming video is the sort of thing that can suffer immensely if it winds up hitting a congestion roadblock. And so they're trying to signal through their paid agreement that this is the sort of thing that we need to pay for prioritization. It's just a market and allocating scarcity.
The problem with that approach from my perspective, or just to play devil's advocate, is that I think everyone feels like whatever they're delivering over the internet needs to have priority, or at least needs to be on an equal playing field with their competitors. Curtis Franklin is a tech journalist. He was on one of our sister shows here this week in Enterprise Tech last week. And the scenario he spun out in response to this rumored deal was, what if someone like Walmart came along and decided that in order to, and I'm not sure I'm paraphrasing him exactly, but the notion was, in order to compete with an online retailer like Amazon, made it so that their web page, you know, we're talking about, oh, a couple of packets dropped for email or web pages, doesn't matter. But if Walmart consistently outperformed Amazon and in its user experience, it might well give that site a competitive edge. And so the fear is that everyone would need to be paying payola to the online service providers in order to ensure that their site is loading in the most efficient and consumer-friendly way possible. And the thing that, that disturbs me about that notion, obviously, you know, we can talk about free markets and competition and having people pay for the service level that they want to deliver, but the consumers are paying for it too, right? I mean, you're paying on the consumer end or on the business end for not just internet access, but a certain level of speed or quality to that internet access. And, you know, at present anyway, the agreements with consumers and businesses do not specify that that access will not only vary by network traffic, but will vary by the deals that we've struck. Mm-hmm.
So a few different things, right? First of all, there's a number of different potential bottlenecks throughout the network of networks that make up the internet, right? So you're never going to be guaranteed an uninterrupted experience because it depends on far too many hops. But what you're seeing, I think, is the development of internet markets as sort of more of a two-sided market, right? One where because you're delivering content from one side to another, you wind up collecting some of your costs from both players. And that can actually be pro-consumer in a way, right? So for one example of this is your local supermarket, right? So it's one of those dirty little secrets that a lot of people know, right? That shelf space is not allocated at random. That companies pay, some companies pay additional money in order to have their product placed at a higher or a lower shelf, a shelf that's sort of eye level or things like that. That's money that comes into the grocery store chain that helps contribute to the ongoing operations and allows the grocery store chain to then offer its goods at a lower price to consumers, right? Prices would be higher otherwise if consumers were footing the entire bill of the SG&A required to run a grocery store. So there's a sense in which a non-net neutral world would open up opportunities for revenue to come from the Googles and Apples of the world that would then offset otherwise potential increases or even, dare I say, lower prices for consumers on the other end. There's no inherent reason why consumers should be footing the entire cost of operating a broadband network. But that
gotcha.
Is one,
hey,
of the, one of the takeaways of a net neutrality rule.
Yeah, I understand. Hey, Evan, one of the things that Daniel mentioned caught my ear in our discussion here, and that's the notion that, you know, we're talking about consumer services by and large and people, you know, wanting to have the best possible video watching experience or shopping experience or whatever it is they're using the web for. And then you get to something like a medical stream where somebody, you know, has a public safety, public health reason to have strong, reliable, fast internet staying up and not being interfered with by other packets. Do you think that, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I think lawmakers would hit on and want to guarantee some minimum level of efficiency and deliverability, don't you think?
Yes, and the example of telemedicine is a nice, easy case to be made for priority being given to a managed or a specialized service because it so clearly encapsulates the public health, public safety, life and limb sort of concern. So yeah, clearly at that end of the spectrum, I don't think many sensible people would disagree that there ought to be some mechanism for priority to be given to those packets. You know, just because I'm torrenting a movie in the, you know, in the neighborhood somewhere in the network shouldn't, you know, slow down the fact that somebody is you know, could suffer greatly because that the telemedicine couldn't be practiced correctly. The difficulties come obviously in the gray areas, the everything that comes in between those obvious examples and then the clearly mundane garden variety things which a proponent of regardless of your perspective on network neutrality would just say is an ordinary traffic on the network. It's much more difficult to be in those gray areas like Apple TV or, you know, this Apple situation that's going on here because it's different than what we ordinarily see. I think part of the problem is that it's Apple, and you know, we then take the pathway up. Well, wait, why is Apple involved here? Well, this is like, you know, coming out of the same heritage as iTunes, and you know, all the content delivery that Apple is famous for, has become famous for in the last 10 years. So it's, if it weren't Apple, there may not be quite as much of a problem drawing the comparisons to some other, you know, something that we wouldn't argue is a specialized service here. So, you know, I'm really intrigued by your work, Daniel, on this, because one thing that has come, you know, one thing that I noticed in what you were saying, and you were alluding to it in your most recent comments there, is that there's nothing inherently wrong with these sort of arrangements. And I think you've also said that perhaps more, you also said that in terms of like data caps, which is, you know, slightly different issue, but a related issue. You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with this. And so seeing how, you know, what you're asking the question, what is the proper way of regulating this, that adds a new perspective to it. And so, Denise, when you were saying, oh, there are these potential consumer problems that could be had, you know, it's going to be bad for the consumer, you know, like with the Walmart situation, Walmart outbidding, outspending, doing whatever so that it got priority over Amazon. I mean, aren't a lot of those concerns really hypothetical at this point? And then, Daniel, I know there's something else that, you know, that you were saying here. We really ought to wait till there truly is an antitrust harm or some other harm. I'm glossing over a lot, I know, so I hope that you'll clarify and fill in the details of what I'm saying here. A lot of those concerns seem hypothetical at this point, not a whole lot of evidence to point to that there really is harm, or that the harm is necessarily all that plausible, and it could be the exact other way around. Is that, you know, what's your reaction to that, Daniel, with that, you know, sort of making that, drawing that comparison there?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think one of the difficult traps that we fall into in internet law, right, is assuming that the way the internet is now is necessarily the way the internet has to be going forward. And I think that's a mistake. The internet that has emerged up to this point, right, is one that was largely filled with email, web pages, a lot of sort of text streams that were not very latency dependent, not very bothered much by things like congestion. But as video has increasingly filled the space, and now these other applications are coming along, right, we're beginning to see not only a different user experience, right, but a wider range of content and applications that are available, but then a wider range of what consumers are using the internet for. Right. And so I'm not sure that it makes sense for a one size fits all policy to continue to be applied to internet traffic management, for example. I think it makes sense to allow broadband providers and content providers to experiment with different combinations, the way, for example, as I mentioned earlier, right, that AT&T and Apple did with the iPhone, to try to introduce new combinations, new products, even if it's not the sort of thing we generally think of as the internet traditionally. And you're absolutely right that antitrust law is an important backstop to this, right? I think there's a huge difference between, for example, Apple paying in order to prevent its product, prevent itself from suffering in the event of congestion, right? And Apple paying Comcast to target YouTube clips and degrade them, right? That would clearly be an anti-competitive agreement, not the sort of thing that I think antitrust law generally would allow. So what this generally gets at, right, is that it's not that there should be no law, but there should be, I think, a presumption in favor of innovation, allowing companies to try new things. And in the event that they prove to be anti-competitive, right, then we bring down the heavy hammer and say, no, you can't do that. But it's sort of a situation of the net neutrality folks really like to talk about permissionless innovation. And I think it's a phrase that should apply with regard to broadband providers as well, right? Let companies innovate and introduce potentially new business models. If consumers like it, they'll take it up. If they don't, or if it causes consumer harm, then you get regulators involved in order to limit the experiment. It's an ex post enforcement rather than an ex ante limit on what you can do.
Right. And that you've written about one example of that with Metro PCS and the programs they were offering customers. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, so this is actually, I think, a really good example. So the obviously net neutrality has going for it the fact that the goal is to promote innovation within the content and application space. But it comes at a cost, right? It comes at a cost of eliminating or at least limiting the amount of innovation that can occur among broadband providers. So MetroPCS was a good example of this in, like, I think it's 2008 or 2009. They were facing a severe competition as Verizon and AT&T were jumping to 4G networks. And MetroPCS didn't have the bandwidth really to compete head-to-head, the bandwidth or the spectrum, right, to compete head-to-head against these giants. So they came up with an alternative pricing plan, right, that was $40 for unlimited talk, unlimited text, unlimited web browsing, and unlimited YouTube video clips, right? They cut a deal with Google to where Google was going to compress YouTube in order to so that it could run over MetroPCS's rather spectrum limited network. And so customers, if they bought the MetroPCS plan, they wouldn't get full internet access, right? Not all the bells and whistles that you get with a Verizon or an AT&T plan, but they get something other than just talk and text. They would have some web browsing, some YouTube video clips, and the benefit to consumers, right, is that it was at a fraction of the price that Verizon and AT&T were charging for the full bells and whistles plans. So MetroPCS was going for a very specific segment of the market, right? It's a market of people who were very cost conscious, who wanted something more than what a feature phone or an old flip phone could give them, right? But couldn't afford the plan of the major carriers. And so hitting that sort of middle market niche. But unfortunately, this was seen as a net neutrality violation because they were offering access to YouTube video and not other video on the same terms. Several consumer groups brought complaints to the FCC and ultimately MetroPCS backed down. And so the takeaway for the MetroPCS saga was that at least when the net neutrality rules were in place, right, you had to offer all of the internet or none at all. And that's a very different world than what we see occurring in a lot of other countries. So in Turkey or in Argentina or Hong Kong, right, some of the most popular wireless plans are plans that offer talk, text, and some limited amount of internet capacity. So a Facebook phone is the really popular one, right? People aren't necessarily interested in paying for unlimited internet access, but they want to be able to access Facebook on the go. So they buy a plan that includes talk, text, and Facebook. Or a plan that includes talk, text, and Twitter, right? One app, but nothing more. And those sorts of plans are at least suspect under most versions of net neutrality here in the United States.
Right. So Beef in IRC is making a comment, kind of a crack, but it gets right to the heart of this. He says, next up, water companies charge more for increased water pressure and clean water's extra as well. Which, you know, I think the point of that is that there's a perception that a telecommunications service like the internet, that limiting down portions of it for a lesser cost isn't really in the public interest, that there is a strong public interest in access for all. And I guess the question becomes, does it make sense to have the business side subsidize that? Do you have a response?
So access for all at what cost, right? So broadband networks aren't free, right? They're literally hundreds of billions of dollars that were invested in building out and maintaining these networks. And it's some estimates are that it'd be up to $20 to $30 or $40 billion annually in order to make sure that we continue to get what we need. It's not clear to me that at current pricing strategies, right, the notion that you pay for all of the internet or nothing at all, that those who can't afford the all price are benefiting, right? There are a number of people who simply are on the wrong end of the digital divide because they don't have an alternative to the unlimited internet model. And this is especially true, I think, in wireless plans. And so part of the need for price differentiation, service differentiation, is to meet the middle market need, right? The people who can't afford the full bells and whistles plan but don't want to be left behind by the digital revolution either. And okay, there's some people who just don't want everything, right?
Right.
one of my colleagues here at BC is very fond of saying, you know, I don't really go on the internet all that much. I don't need access to everything. What I need access is to my remote server and Netflix. And if I had that, that's 90% of my time online. I think if you looked at the amount of time you spend online, you'd find that 80% of your time is spent on only a handful of sites anyway.
Right. And you were saying before, you know, you could have the internet provider try and guess what it is how you would prioritize your internet usage. Do you foresee a future where maybe a way that providers compete with one another is to allow people to check a box and say, this really matters to our business or our household, and this does not, and prioritize traffic that way?
I think it's possible. I don't think I think it's good for those types of plans to be introduced into the marketplace. I don't think they would ever come to dominate the market, because I do agree that sort of unlimited internet access is what most of us demand, right? So one of the big differences between, I think, broadband internet access and the water company is that if the water company tried to charge you extra for clean water, there's really nowhere else you could go, right? The broadband market is at least workably competitive. In most of the United States, you have at least two providers, the cable company and the phone company. And if one of them tries to undercut, you could switch to the other. Now, right, two providers is not as good as three or four or five, which would be a much better facilities-based competitive model. But technology is moving us in that direction, right? Depending on what service you're talking about, you have a wireless option or up to four or five different wireless options for certain information over broadband networks in addition to your home connection. And satellite is getting better. It's still perfect, but prices are coming down, latency is going up, and we might see a time short when satellite winds up being a good competitive alternative to the wire-based internet we have now, the same way that satellite television is... The DirecTVs and Dish Networks of the world were what finally shook up the cable television monopoly.
All right, I have one more question, and then I'm sure Marty and or Evan may have some comments or questions as well before we get off the net neutrality subject here. And I'm wondering, I know you've written a lot about retransmission consent and the cable business as well. I'm wondering if there's a parallel here to the way that industry has been regulated to allow broadcasters to reach their audience, and the way that the internet may be regulated to allow either video broadcasters to reach their audience or just anyone sending packets over the net. Do you see any sort of parallel between retransmission consent and must carry and the whole net neutrality conundrum?
Yeah, I think there are a number of parallels. The fact that the cable providers are a similar two-sided market, and it's unclear who's got the market power in a given time, right? So when cable first came out, they were literally picking up broadcast signals for free and retransmitting them to customers. It's one of those secrets hidden in history that the original cable model, right, was not HBO and Cinemax and Disney Channel, right? The original cable companies were simply picking up over-the-air television and rebroadcasting those signals to people who couldn't get good signals through rabbit ears on their TV, right? And eventually the broadcaster said, look, if you're making money off our signal, we need a cut of that. And so that's where the retransmission consent rules originally came from. Congress agreed and told the cable companies they couldn't retransmit a broadcaster's signal without their consent. And the idea was that broadcasters would withhold that consent in exchange for some cut of cable money. Well, when CBS first tried to hold out in 1993, they found out quickly that although cable companies liked having CBS, they didn't like it enough to pay for it, right? And so they held the line. The cable company said, fine, our customers just won't get CBS. They'll get everybody else. And CBS ended up agreeing to allow their signal for free over cable companies, the cable companies' networks. NBC and Fox and ABC held out for something a little different. They also didn't get any money, right? But they agreed, they managed to get space on the cable channel space on the cable system for another cable channel, right? So Fox used their space in order to create the FX network, and ABC used their space in order to create ESPN2. So these were deals that were good for broadcasters, right? Because they were making more money now. They had a cable channel in addition to their broadcast channel. But it wasn't necessarily good for broadcasting, right? Because ABC is now splitting its time between its broadcast network and ESPN2 in a way that it didn't before. So if Congress's goal was to boost broadcasting, it wasn't clear to me that this goal was really well served. But for a long time, it really looked like the market price for broadcast content on a cable network was zero. But if you fast forward now to, 20 years later, retransmission consent is suddenly a huge amount of money, right? It's something like $2 or $3 billion a year that cable companies are paying to broadcasters, and that amount is growing. As broadcasters are tying up more content that customers really want, customers are making sure the cable companies have their broadcast channels, and so the cable companies have to pay retransmission consent. So it's a market that's emerged over time. And sometimes the dollars flow one way, and sometimes it's quite possible, right, the dollars will flow another. That's kind of what Must Carry was, which was forcing cable companies to carry those stations that weren't really worth, that the cable company didn't even want to dedicate space to otherwise. And so the fluidity of the market over time showed, I think, that it's a mistake to assume the way things are is the way they're always going to be. If you thought as a result of CBS's breakdown in negotiations in 1993 that, oh, well, I guess broadcast is always going to be available for free on cable systems, you'd be really wrong. And you would have failed to predict the way in which the market has grown because of the ability of the two sides to negotiate.
Okay, I'm glad I wasn't crazy in thinking that there was some kind of parallel development there or an analogy to be drawn. Evan, any further thoughts or questions for Professor Lyons?
Well, again, just to reiterate, I'm impressed by the scholarship you've done on this, Daniel, about just advocating for an ex post enforcement rather than ex ante. It reminds me a little bit of conversations we've had on the show before where we talk about Google Glass. And, it seems like I get tomatoes thrown at me in the chat room when I say, well, for example, it was a good thing that the woman got arrested for using glass while driving because, it's an important public issue, public safety issue. And what I'm doing really there is advocating for an ex ante sort of enforcement, not giving enough time. And I'm critiquing my own commentary here by saying, we're not giving enough time to see how Google Glass will be used in the marketplace to see if there's actual harm. Sure, we have to wait till at least 10,000 people lose their, are decapitated in traffic accidents because of it before we start regulating it. I see the parallel to that, and it makes me a little bit surprised that there's not more of a sentiment that comes to the net neutrality debate saying, hey, why are we so quick to say that there must be a neutral network or, that there must be an open internet, whatever, no packet discrimination, what have you. Why don't we wait to see that there's some harm here? So I see a little bit of a paradox in sort of the vox populi with how those things are going. So it's I think it's interesting the things that you've said along those lines, Daniel, about the way this should be regulated, seeing where the harm is going to be.
Thank you, appreciate that. And I think it's really important to recognize, right, that lack of ex ante rules doesn't mean there's no law whatsoever, right? Antitrust law remains a backstop to this market as it is with every market in the United States, right? To make sure that when competition fails to protect consumers, regulators can step in. One of the big arguments that will take place in this space going forward is whether the right regulator to step in is the Federal Trade Commission, right, which usually regulates antitrust abuse, or the FCC, which has a good understanding of the way that information networks in particular operate. I guess I'm a little bit partial toward the latter, but I don't have a strong view either way, as long as the rule is one that looks at harm to competition, not necessarily harm to a particular competitor, and doesn't prefer one business model over another.
Well, we have a couple of winners in just the recent couple of minutes of discussion. One is me, because I now have our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're listening to the show for continuing legal education credit, you may have to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. So we put these phrases in case you have an oversight board that wants to be able to have that shown. Our first one's going to be hashtag cancel Evan. In light of it could be throwing tomatoes, but let's go with hashtag cancel Evan. And the other winner, I think, is anyone playing the Twill drinking game with today's episode, which of course includes imbibing whenever a Monty Python reference comes up or any sort of Latin. So ex ante and vox populi, you know, you guys are doing well on your Friday so far. Marty, any comments on net neutrality or questions for Professor Lyons before we move on?
No, I'm out of my depth here. I'm just listening and learning. And just trying to write down quick Monty Python references to put into my segment.
That's good, good, good. We should be able to. Hasn't Weird Al done a Monty Python parody? If not, he should. Let's move on to some trademark related stuff with Marty and talk for a bit about parody and satire and how trademarks can be used and not used in that context. There is a long history of people pushing the legal envelope here and some recent developments down in Cajun country that Marty can bring us up to speed on. Marty, why don't you first give us the background of the law in this area?
So I have a big note to myself here not to forget the reason why I wanted to discuss this, which is not really to educate about the satire and parody distinction in trademark law, but just to bring up as a topic as to whether the state of Louisiana is improperly misusing the Lanham Act to suppress political speech that it is not satisfied with. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Dr. Seuss and Cats Not in Hats.
So just to set the stage for this, there is a lawsuit that's in Louisiana right now. The plaintiff is the lieutenant governor of Louisiana, and the defendant is MoveOn.org. And it does involve MoveOn putting up billboards that parody or just copy a slogan of Louisiana's tourism push. So as background, let's talk a little bit about the cat is not in the hat. I want to warn the audience that we haven't worked with the visuals yet. How is this going to work?
There you go. Mm-hmm.
All right. So we know that there's such a thing as satire and there's such a thing as parody, and I'm not quite sure everyone could define it. The law seems to be this. Parody is a defense in both trademark and copyright cases, but satire does not seem to be. And courts have defined it as a parody will borrow the protectable mechanism of the original work to comment on the original. A satire will borrow some form of original work to comment on a different topic. So maybe we could do the Cat in the Hat back. Could we return that? So on the left is the children's classic, The Cat in the Hat, and the right was a book, The Cat is Not in the Hat, which refers to itself as a parody, and it is not by Dr. Seuss, but by Dr. Juice. And this was a book that was published in the 90s, shortly after the O.J. Simpson case, and you can tell from the cover that it borrows Dr. Seuss's font style, his drawing style. The text of the book utilizes Dr. Seuss's distinctive rhythm. And this is what the court said. We're determining that the subject of your book, Dr. Juice, is O.J. You are not commenting on Dr. Seuss. Therefore, this is not a permissible parody. It is a satire. You have borrowed Dr. Seuss's protectable elements to comment on a third party, and therefore it is an infringement.
It's just unfortunate that the court didn't do that in Dr. Seussian prose.
You're right, although as an attorney, sometimes, you know, in trademark and copyright cases, the judges sort of feel that this is a license for them to be funny in their decisions. And my reaction is, please take my case seriously. Don't do this in prose. So we have this distinction satire versus parody. And it is criticized for many, many reasons. Can we roll the Weird Al clip, please? Here's the thing about Weird Al, which is that does he really talk about the original work or does he talk about other things? And I think that Weird Al embodies both satire and parody in that he will comment on the original work and make fun of it, but then he'll also make fun of food and the Amish and anything else that comes to his mind. So as an aside, Weird Al, it's my understanding that he always tends to obtain licenses to do his work.
Even though he may not have to.
Right. I think it's more about who, you know, life is too short to have a lawsuit. So Weird Al kind of shows that as an artistic matter, the satire versus parody distinction is not all that workable. But let me give you an example where I think a case really made the distinction workable. Let's roll the Ralph Nader clip, please. So you will recall, probably, that MasterCard has a somewhat well-known theme of commercials, the Priceless campaign, in which they will show multiple images with the price of something. For example, father taking a kid to a baseball game, so they'll say that the tickets cost whatever, and the hot dog costs this, and the souvenirs cost that. But spending a day at the ball game with your kid is priceless. So Ralph Nader ran for president in the year 2000, and he had a commercial that was clearly structured to refer to the MasterCard campaign. And it said, you just saw it, that contributing to this candidate, so many dollars and so on, knowing the truth, priceless, right? So try on your satire versus parody distinction. What is the subject of this ad? Ralph Nader is the most direct message is he's commenting on the role of money in the political system. Right. So is he criticizing MasterCard? The Southern District of New York, in one of its more insightful decisions in this field of law, said, listen, works of art have more than one message. Many will criticize MasterCard's theme, which is that somewhat hypocritical to say, listen, you have to buy all these things like the baseball ticket in order to have this non-materialistic experience. Ralph Nader is similarly talking about, he is making an anti-materialistic comment, so he's implicitly criticizing MasterCard as well as criticizing the role of money in politics. And it was found not to be infringement on either trademark or a copyright theory. So that, I will submit, is an example of the satire parody distinction becoming somewhat workable. But then again, you need to have a judge who gets the joke, who understands these sorts of things.
So I was really worried, Marty, when we decided to have you back on the show, that you and I would devolve the show, now that I've become a dog owner, into This Week in Rescue Dogs as opposed to This Week in Law. So we have one more example, right, that may give us the opportunity to do that.
Well, this shows you really how troubling, I mean, it doesn't always work. Let's go. Here's Chewy Vuitton. So obviously Louis Vuitton will have a variety of famous trademarks for its handbags. And someone came out with Chew Toys, and this is Chewy Vuitton. So what is this a parody? What is it commenting on? It shows you a different problem, which is that there's this other aspect of trademark law, which is the likelihood of confusion. I should say it's the main aspect of trademark law. Does anyone think that this Louis Vuitton chew toy derives from Louis Vuitton? That the circuit court found not at all, no likelihood of confusion. And also Louis Vuitton lost on a dilution theory, much to INTA's horror. All right, let's go to the case in chief. So the state of Louisiana promotes tourism, and it has a motto, pick your passion. So do we have, here we go. All right, so Louisiana, pick your passion, and it promotes tourism and other forms of economic activity in Louisiana. MoveOn.org is an advocacy organization, and it put up billboards. All right, so this is a billboard, and we learned from this case that you have 6 seconds to read a billboard when you're driving on a highway. This was in Baton Rouge, and it says, Louisiana, pick your passion but hope you don't love your health. Governor Jindal's denying Medicaid to 242,000 people. Okay, home viewers, what is this? Is this trademark infringement? What do we got here? Does anyone want to, do any of our my panelists want to kind of do an off-the-top-of-their-head analysis of this?
I would, but I've read your post, so I know the answer. Or I know your take on the answer anyway. What do you think, Evan?
Well, the touchstone is likelihood of confusion. So in my 6 seconds of driving by and seeing this, I need to ask myself whether I think that the state of Louisiana, more sincerely, the lieutenant governor's office, right, is the source of the services that I'm being marketed in this billboard. So that's what I'll ask myself. And so I'll stop and think about that while, you know.
What services are being marketed by the Move On billboard?
Yeah, I think my silence is probably the best answer on that.
Okay. So the trademark, Louisiana Pick Your Passion, it's a registered trademark, and it's owned by the lieutenant governor of Louisiana. As an analogy, in New York, we have the famous I Heart New York trademarks, and that happens to be owned by the Department of Economic Development of New York. So lieutenant governor of Louisiana has sued, and in anticipation of this doctrine of that the parody has to comment on the original, they have argued that Move On is commenting on Governor Jindal, but it's the lieutenant governor who owns this trademark. Because they're not commenting on him, then they don't fall under this parody or cat and not in hat theory, right? So Denise is referring to my post. My reaction to that argument is that that is transparent sophistry. It's as if, so many trademark owners or IP owners put their IP in holding companies, and it's like Lady Gaga saying, if you did a Lady Gaga parody, oh, because my holding company owns my intellectual property, you could only properly comment on my holding company, but if you're commenting on me, you fall out of this parody exception. So I think that is sophistry.
Right. Someone in chat is making the argument that a trademark owned by any public entity is owned by the people of the state by extension.
So, I mean, it is worth thinking about exactly who owns this. Who does it inure to the benefit of? I guess my question is, if you felt that the campaign was done poorly, who would you complain or who would take the credit? As I said, in New York, it's the Department of Economic Development that owns our various pro-tourism trademarks. But I think we have this unformed, as I'm driving by on the highway, I have this unformed argument, it's the state, it's the government, or perhaps the executive branch that I believe is responsible for these things. And if, for example, a restaurant was to misuse some sort of state indicia, I say, well, they're falsely suggesting that they're endorsed by the government. It's really hard to say who exactly owns it. It's even harder to say whether these are true trademarks. What is Louisiana really promoting when they say they're promoting tourism? I mean, what services are they rendering? That's the huge problem with this sort of trademark and this sort of case. I'd like to recommend that everyone go to the PACER docket on this case. Louisiana has filed a preliminary injunction motion. It was heard yesterday. So Louisiana's papers are up on PACER. Move On's reply. Most interestingly, Louisiana has submitted a survey. I took a quick look at it. It polled 200 people in Baton Rouge, and they showed them it was an online thing. So they saw the billboards on their screen. They saw them for 6 seconds, and then they saw the other one immediately after, which is possibly a survey error. And they said, well, do you think that these billboards came from the same source? And then they asked that question 3 times in a row, which also could distort the answers. They say that about 25% of the people surveyed believe that the billboards derive from the same source. 25% is actionable confusion. Should point that out. Their numbers may not be good. I saw some problems with the survey. We'll see. But then we get to this larger problem, which is, what is the confusion here? What happens? Do I think that MoveOn is sponsored by Louisiana? What is the actual harm? Since we had the eBay versus Merck Exchange Supreme Court case, it's not enough to win a preliminary injunction in an IP case where you merely say they did the wrong thing. They infringed. There was a likelihood of confusion. You have to show some form of actionable harm. What is the actionable harm in this case that the trademark law is supposed to protect? Do you think that MoveOn is sponsored by the state of Louisiana? Do you think that the lieutenant governor is critical of Governor Jindal?
The governor, yeah.
Right. So it's a fairly unworkable theory. Granted, satire and parody is a little bit of a mess.
Yeah.
But in the end, let's not lose sight of the fact that the state of Louisiana is moving to suppress a billboard that makes political speech. We can go a lot of ways from this, but let's have some questions.
Yeah, a couple of points. Is there a copyright claim as well? Because I mean, that would, you know, circumvent these problems of consumer confusion and who's sending the message and all that stuff. There is a creative element to it.
Yeah, the design aspects.
There's no focus on copyright in the papers. There could be a copyright claim because not only did they copy that Louisiana logo, but they referred to like Cajun cooking, which is like was the subject of one of the state's billboards. So there's the potential for copyright, but again, you'd have that parody defense that it's a comment on the original. That is the move on. I could not find a state of Louisiana one, but there is something. Mm-hmm. Similar. And again, obviously the logos are supposed to be similar.
Yeah. Daniel, I have a hard time thinking that a court would let federal copyright law be the vehicle by which a state could quell critical political speech. Don't you?
Yeah, I agree. This isn't really my area of the law, but my knee-jerk reaction is to think that political speech is, you know, the core of what the First Amendment protects. And this seems... I agree with you, Marty. This seems to me almost quintessential sort of strategic lawsuit against public participation, right?
Well, something like the Chewy Vuitton case is so much more difficult to address because it's, you know, commercial activity. Mm-hmm. In a case like this, where MoveOn is talking about the number one political issue of this decade, for better or for worse, healthcare. You can't get more political speechy. That's actually kind of what the court in the Nader case said. This guy's running for president. You can't get more First Amendment-y than this sort of case. So absolutely, very troubling that the case is brought at all.
First Amendment-y, I like it. Let me drop our second MCLE passphrase into the episode, and that's going to be dog with a purse. Since I don't know how we let Chewy Vuitton go by without making it some official part of the show. Our first passphrase leads into my next question for Marty. on the subject of satire this last week. We've seen a huge firestorm hit Twitter and the airwaves over Stephen Colbert and an ill-advised tweet that someone at Comedy Central put out that was making a reference to some satire that Colbert did on the show of which sports organization was it, Marty? Somebody was trying to appease the American Indian population, and Colbert came in and said, "We're going to do the same thing for Chinese people. We're going to establish a foundation," and he called it, you know, something terrible, Ching Chong Ding Dong, and upset a lot of people. And they tweeted a reference to that satire. So how does that all fit into what we've been discussing?
So to kind of go on one aspect of the satire parody thing is that to a great extent, you need contextual information to get a joke. So as a little bit of background, Dan Snyder is the owner of the Washington Redskins. And as many people will know, Native American groups have been contesting the use of the name Redskins for decades at this point. As an aside, I really see no vehicle in the trademark law any longer to do anything about the name. That ship has sailed. So Dan Snyder, as an attempt, as Denise points out, to appease groups, he came out with the Washington Redskins Foundation for Native Americans or something like that. So Colbert, in his show, made the joke about how great it is to calm relations with a group by using a slur of that group's name in your foundation's name.
Yes.
And he said, in my example, and taking a page from Snyder's book, I'm going to have the Ching Chong Ding Dong be sensitive to Orientals or whatever foundation. So with context, what you know about Colbert, you know where he stands and you get the joke. So you know that it is an anti-racism joke, not a pro-racism one. It turns out that someone at Comedy Central puts in a tweet that said simply, contribute to the Ching Chong Ding Dong, be sensitive to Orientals or whatever foundation. And there's no link to any of the contextual information. So someone who's a Korean American and has referred to herself as a hashtag activist previously and has done other Twitter-based forms of protest said that tweet itself was racist and began a cancel Colbert hashtag. There is commentary that even her campaign was meant somewhat ironically, was not to be taken at face value. Colbert has responded and he said, who would have thought that a medium that limits you to 140 characters would lead to a misunderstanding? And I think we have a link to his video on our show notes in which he discusses the whole thing and basically says what we've just told you, which is that in its context, it is not a racist joke. And if you take it out of context, as it did in the tweet, it could be misconstrued as a racist joke. So it goes to show you really need, oh, there we go. So I think we have this.
Who's attacking me now? Okay. We do. We have links to everything we've been discussing today on the show and even more at our Delicious page, which is for this episode, delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/253. If you want your primer for the show, that's where to go and get it. So, Marty, I guess it's just demonstrating what courts have to deal with when they're considering whether this parody defense applies and the role of satire, that context is important too.
Well, as I said, I really thought the priceless Southern District of New York decision from 2000 was fairly insightful, but I also have to acknowledge that the judge, I think, had a level of insight and analysis that may not be that the viewer at home in the 30 seconds that they see the commercial may not have done. In the Louisiana case, it is correctly pointed out that the person, the motorist, has about 6 seconds to evaluate. So it's very troubling when a judge will have lots of time with lots of contextual information to evaluate the point of a work, and that we have to face the fact that perhaps out in the street, out in the wild, people do misunderstand things or don't have contextual information. Look at the people who only would have seen the Colbert tweet and not the original segment. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know whether that's a good reason to suppress Colbert, that people don't get your joke, but it is what it is.
So you had one final example for us of how to do parody correctly that involved Ford.
Oh, you know what? As long as I'm saying one final example, I should answer a question that a lot of people are asking about, which is that Ronald McDonald commercial.
Yeah. In fact, we were going to make this our tip of the week. So why don't we, or I actually think we have a couple of tips of the week. Let's do this one now. Ronald McDonald and Taco Bell, if you're going to use your competitor's trademark, what do you need to bear in mind here, Marty?
So as background, Taco Bell is having a commercial where they went out and they found lots of people whose real name was Ronald McDonald. And they flew them in and they showed them whatever new product Taco Bell is pushing these days. And all these people named Ronald McDonald are saying, wow, this is magnificent. And I'm getting a lot of email from the trademark blog. Is this lawful? And the sad thing is that I've been in trademark law long enough that I'm seeing the same fact patterns over. Here we go. Here's a Ronald McDonald enjoying the Taco Bell. In 1993, Ramada went out and found all sorts of people named Marriott, and they put them up in a Ramada, and then the commercial was, oh, all these guys named Marriott like Ramada. So Marriott sued. And the judge says, again, the standard is likelihood of confusion. If you look at this commercial, you see what's going on. Ramada has clearly gotten guys named Marriott as a joke to say that they like Ramada. And here, it's not a subtle commercial. People named Ronald McDonald, who oddly don't have orange hair or clown makeup, like Taco Bell. And so people see what it is. Okay. So I guess the tip of the week is, if you're going to use your competitor's trademark, just don't be confusing. Be fairly clear. You see, here is Ronald McDonald of Oak Ridge, North Carolina. Again, if you'd put these guys in orange hair and clown makeup, maybe you'd start to be confusing. But we kind of know exactly what we're looking at. So the tip of the week, don't be confusing. Be clear.
Got it. And does the Ford Cadillac parody follow that rule?
I think the Ford parody can. Do we have it? Or I know that I sent the link in.
Yeah.
Many of you, for some reason, that Cadillac commercial during the Super Bowl hit a nerve. What they've done here is that they've borrowed the pacing and the editing of the Cadillac commercial, which is just a person and the subject and the tone. What this is that this person is talking about sustainability. They'll have people walk past her in the way in which the original Cadillac ad does. There is no confusion.
Yeah, look, it's pretty simple. You work hard, you believe that anything is possible, and you try to make the world better. You try. As for helping the city grow good, green, healthy vegetables, that's the upside of giving a damn. Nespa.
So the use of Nespa, I think, is the only word that they borrow that was used in the original Cadillac. To me, this is a perfect parody. You have borrowed enough to refer to the original, but you have not confused. So That's how it's done. If a client came to me and said, how close can I come? I'd show them this Ford commercial and say, that's the way to do it.
Cool. Thank you so much, Marty. Hey, Evan, I threw in another tip of the week, not to throw you for a loop, but it's out of your Twitter stream, and we were talking about it before the show. And I think the tip we could glean here is mixing Facebook and moonshine, not a good idea. You want to tell us why?
Yeah. Now let's now the conversation gets more spirited, right? Yeah, this goes to that whole idea of this is the umpteenth time we've talked about this, the potentially harmful effects of social media as evidence. There's a guy near Tell City, Indiana, who was making moonshine with a still in his home. You know, this isn't the prohibition era, but still, you know, it's better than making meth, which is what a lot of people in Indiana are doing. But in any event, I digress. Posted the pictures of his still on Facebook, and there you have it. He got arrested, and I'm not sure where the criminal case is, but, you know, if you're going to be making moonshine, get a license for that, pay your taxes on it. I'm sure that's the real issue here, because the charges all relate to, you know, excise taxes and things like that, the whole idea of unregulated liquor.
So I guess the flip side of this tip is you can brew beer at home, but not moonshine.
I guess so. Yeah. I haven't studied the nuances of that, but you know, they sell beer making kits at Walmart. I suppose that's a hint.
No, I have to interrupt. You can make moonshine at home. I have a client. I'll give them a plug. Clawhammer Supply. Go look them up and buy some stills. I think you can only make it for your home. I'm totally serious. You can make it for home use. But again, watch out for the revenuers.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Our resource of the week is a little bit more elevated in its tone. It is from Daniel, and we were having our discussion on retransmission consent and must carry. All of these are very important considerations and things to be able to understand, and they are very complicated. Hopefully, Daniel has written a primer on the retransmission consent and must carry rules, something that's very, very pertinent as the Supreme Court considers the Aereo case. Anything you want to add to this or just put it in context for us, Daniel?
I appreciate the plug. Yeah, so the piece is designed to sort of put into layman's terms what the rules are regarding what the cable company can carry, what they can't, and why it matters to you, the consumer, who winds up footing the bill for these increasingly growing retransmission consent fees.
So this is available at Tech Policy Daily, another good resource that I had not yet come across before this, but all kinds of good information there. So thank you very much, Daniel. I know that every time these issues come up on the show, I have to kind of go study up on them and try and get my head around why they're there and how they work and how they're such a huge, as you pointed out, $2 to $3 billion annually driver in the broadcast arena right now. Any thoughts on the upcoming Aereo case before the Supreme Court, Daniel?
I think it's a fascinating case. I'm not sure the Supreme Court has got the exact right posture for it, but that's because I'm a telecom scholar, right? So I'm not as interested in the copyright question about whether they can or can't carry a broadcaster's signal as much as I am the telecom question about what is this going to do to the future of the cable industry. Either Aereo wins and we learn that you can have a architecture that looks completely economically insane in order to fit the machinations of copyright law, or they lose. But either way, I think you're going to see some pressure continue to be put on cable television. I think cable prices are growing such that consumers are looking for alternatives. Aereo is one example of that. Peer-to-peer networking is another example, and the increased amount of video piracy. I think people are looking for competitive alternatives, and I think the cable industry eventually is going to have to respond.
And how do you think they will?
So one effort that's going through Congress right now is a la carte pricing, the notion that rather than buying all of your cable channels together, you pick and choose only the ones you want to watch and pay only for those. It's not clear to me how the economics of that will work out. I think more likely you're going to see an over-the-top internet-based cable system going forward. Intel pioneered the technology a couple of years ago, but couldn't get the content rights in order to get it to work. They sold the technology to Verizon, and the rumor is that Apple is experimenting with this technology as well. If so, it means that you might have a competitor to your traditional cable company, right? Somebody who can send the exact same thing over the internet and reach nationwide. And if so, that would put price pressure on the traditional cable alternatives.
So let's go back to our earlier discussion of net neutrality and figure out how that plays in. If we are going to have a true over-the-top competitor to cable and satellite, how's that going to work, do you think, on the net neutrality side?
Right. So this is where the rubber hits the road with regard to net neutrality, right? Where the real concern is what we call vertical integration, right? We're worried that because Comcast controls the broadband pipe to your house, they might do something that prevents you from getting online video if it means that it's going to damage their cable division, right? So protecting, leveraging their power over broadband in order to prop up a slowly dying cable market. And that's the sort of thing that antitrust law is very familiar with and knows exactly how to handle. What they say is first step is to look for whether the company has market power, right? Whether the consumer has a competitive alternative. Because if Comcast, for example, just use them as an example, right, is engaging in nefarious behavior, but consumers can switch to Verizon or AT&T or Cox or someone like that, right, for their internet service, then there's no problem because the market can punish bad behavior. If not, then you go to the next level and say, well, is what's going on here harmful to consumers or not? And if so, then you end up with a sanction. We had an example of that in the FCC a few years ago in a company called Madison River, which was a local telephone company that was beginning to provide DSL service but was blocking Vonage, right, the over-the-top internet-based VoIP provider. And the idea was they didn't want Madison River customers to turn off their traditional phone service and use Vonage instead. And the FCC sanctioned that behavior, and I think rightfully so, because that's an example where ex post enforcement remedied harm to competition.
Got it. Well, we've come full circle, and I think we've covered a lot of ground on this show, and we'll go ahead and leave it at that. I'm so excited that we've had the opportunity to chat with such great people today. Daniel Lyons from Boston College Law School. Anything going on at the law school or in your own scholarship that you want to let us know about before we sign off?
So I just released a new paper on that teases out some of the details on these alternative wireless plans. It's called Innovations in Mobile Broadband Pricing. It's released by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And it gets into a little bit more about what are the alternatives to the all-you-can-eat internet model and whether it's a good or a bad idea to allow companies to experiment. So thanks for the opportunity to plug it.
Sure, we will check that out. I think I already have it in the show notes, which I mentioned before. Marty, great to see you again.
Great seeing you, Denise. Great seeing you, Evan. Nice meeting you, Daniel.
How are all your pets doing?
All my pets?
Yes. How's your doggy?
Banner says hello.
Good. We miss Banner. All right. Wonderful chatting with you. Other than simply keeping the world apprised on the all the latest and greatest developments in trademark law, anything going on with you that you'd like to let us know about?
No, just subscribe to @trademarkblog and I'll keep all you need to know.
Great. Thanks so much. Evan, great chatting with you. Thank you for instilling some moonshine into our show today, and as well as the sunshine that you always bring to the show. How are things in Chicago these days?
Things are great. You know, it's looking up. It's springtime here. We enjoyed spring break this week, so we actually made it up to the Twin Cities and enjoyed, you know, the great commercial thing that the U.S. produces called the Mall of America. So, you know, it's sort of a vacation mode here, but working hard in any event. And, you know, just I think I mentioned already, I got a few speaking engagements lined up coming up over the summer. Going to be talking about the ethics of trolling, intellectual property trolling, and then all the way over to be talking about Bitcoin as well. So I'm looking forward to the warmer weather and some talks I'm going to be giving. I'll keep people up on those things. They're all here in the Chicago area. So it's some interesting learning and dropping the knowledge. It's going to be fun.
I have a quick question for Evan.
Sure.
Evan?
Yes.
Chicago Cubs or White Sox fan?
Well, I'm a Cubs fan, you know, and I don't believe in shedding blood over any of it. I wasn't born in Chicago, but you know, I'm married into a family where we're a Cubs family here. So did I answer correctly from your perspective?
Well, I wanted your comment that George Wills wrote this week that he feels that the longtime failure of the Cubs is due to the fact that Cubs fans are too forgiving. So that he applied something of an economic incentive and disincentive model, that you guys need to be more critical of them. Now, do you feel that that's a fair criticism, or is that blaming the victim?
Well, I tell you what, Cubs fans can certainly be unforgiving, but not necessarily in relation to the team itself. If you go back to, I think it was 2003, if you'll remember, it was the, toward the end of the series where a fan interfered with catching a pop fly in the outfield. And that poor guy, you know, essentially got run out of town because it essentially meant the loss of the game. His name was Bartman. If you just do that, it's a Wikipedia moment for that. So there's certainly the capacity to be unforgiving in the Cubs fan heart. But so maybe there could be this 100-century-long drought could have something to do with where that unforgiveness is being directed. So I'm going to have to evaluate George Will's commentary a little bit there.
Okay, good, very point. Good.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So I've been winding down the show and we're talking baseball now. And I realized that we had this lengthy discussion of net neutrality without even mentioning the fact that the European Parliament has just voted in favor of a very strong net neutrality law. So before we let Daniel go, I just wanted to see, Daniel, you were talking before how in many countries there's a much more open market competition approach towards what sort of internet services are offered and how they're priced and what's included. The EU seems to be going the other direction, and I wanted to get your take real quick before we sign off.
Yeah, so this is one part of a larger experiment with the EU to try to mold a series of regional cell phone markets and wire-based markets into one large common market, right? This is a bill that the Parliament has voted on. My understanding is it doesn't become law until the Council of the European Union votes upon it, but that's probably likely to happen. It'll set up a nice natural experiment, I think, if the U.S. continues on a more competitive track to see which one winds up being better for consumers. We had a similar experiment in the wireless space about 10 years ago. The EU mandated that each wireless provider adopt GSM technology, 3G GSM technology. Whereas in the United States, we allowed companies to experiment, and some went with GSM and some went with the alternative, right, the CDMA technology. And from that competition between AT&T and Verizon, we got ultimately 4G LTE networks. And so now we're light years ahead of Europe in that respect, because everybody in Europe is still stuck on what the regulatory apparatus demanded of the previous generation. So we'll see how it works out, but I'm happy that we get this sort of natural experiment to see which winds up being the better policy for consumers.
All right. So on that note, we will go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. Thank you so much for all your input, gentlemen. Folks, if you're watching us on Friday, that means you've tuned in at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record the show live. If you're watching it some other time, that probably means that you've picked us up off iTunes or YouTube or from our site, twit.tv/twill. Hopefully our packets are coming through loud and clear and strong and reliably, and we'll continue to do so. If you'd like to get in touch with us between the shows, please do so. We get wonderful comments, feedback, suggestions from the audience, and the way you can do that is email us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. Send us stuff on Twitter. Twitter, Evan's Internet Cases there. I'm D Howell. We have a Facebook page and a Google Plus page and a community over on Google Plus. So pick your poison and get in touch with us. Definitely let us know your responses to what we've discussed and what we should be talking about next and who we should be talking about it with. And with that, we will let you go. Have a great weekend, and we will see you the next week on This Week in Law.